Hundreds of people are dead following an Indonesian earthquake. As rescuers search for survivors, the country was hit by another earthquake. And these are just two of four big earthquakes over the last couple of days. The others were in Samoa and Peru. All are considered part of the Pacific Rim, which has the world's most active fault lines. NPR's Richard Harris has been looking at whether the tremors were related or just a coincidence.
You've got to wonder, did the first big one trigger the others? Ross Stein at the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park, California, says it's not a crazy idea.
The interesting thing is, any earthquake of, let's say, magnitude 6 or larger sends out its ripple of seismic waves, just like throwing a stone into a pond. And for a magnitude 6 or larger, those waves encircle the entire globe, and every single sand grain on the planet is dancing to that music.
So when it comes to seismic waves, the world really is all interconnected.
But the tough question is, okay, you shook the region, but did you trigger an earthquake, which is something else?
That's much harder to do. In the case of this week's event, it's true that the Samoa quake and the Sumatra quake took place on opposite edges of a giant slab of earth called the Australian Plate.
However, the plate itself as a whole doesn't move. The plate is basically a thin slab of rubber sliding over honey. And it bangs and bends on the borders, but the entire plate isn't moving at once.
So there's no expectation that a single plate-wide event could be behind this 1-2 punch. Stein says the quakes, along with one in Peru, all occurred in places where big quakes happen a lot.
Would you expect them all to occur in a 24-hour period? I don't know, and I haven't looked at that.
But a colleague of his down the hall has looked at whether big quakes trigger other quakes. Tom Parsons says the answer is a resounding yes, but with a very important caveat.
They tend to happen within about 1,000 kilometers of their source.
Which is 600 miles or so.
Right. And in this case, the Sumatra and Samoan events are more than 10,000 kilometers apart.
Parson has pored through the records of all potentially damaging earthquakes over the past 30 years, magnitude 7 or higher. He looked at more than 200 quakes in all to see if big quakes trigger other big quakes far away, and he simply doesn't see that pattern. So what can explain the pair of big quakes this week? Well, Parson says there are on average 6 or 7 quakes a year with magnitudes greater than 7, so it's not too likely that any of these will happen on the same day, but it certainly can happen. Parsons has a simpler explanation for the large quake near the Indonesian island of Sumatra.
Of course, in the Sumatra area is very active at the moment because of the giant earthquake that happened there back in 2004. So if you were going to blame this most recent event on anything, I'd probably look at that big magnitude 9 event that happened then as the root cause more than the Samoa event.
That 2004 event was the quake that caused the devastating tsunami that swept across the Indian Ocean. And ever since then, we've paid a lot more attention to big quakes, even those that strike way out at sea. Richard Harris, NPR News.
The tree of life just got a little more complicated. Scientists working in Ethiopia have unveiled a trove of fossil bones that they say come from our oldest known ancestor. Among the bones are those of a female who's been named Ardi. She apparently weighed about 110 pounds and stood about 4 feet high. She lived in trees but could walk on the ground. As NPR's Christopher Joyce explains, Ardi pushes back human history a long way.
Move over Lucy. That diminutive creature discovered 35 years ago in Ethiopia became the poster child for our earliest out-of-the-trees ancestors. But now comes Ardi. Ardi lived 4.4 million years ago. That's a million years before Lucy. Scientists say that makes Ardi the closest they've come to finding the elusive common ancestor of humans and chimpanzees. Anthropologists suspect that about 6 or 7 million years ago, some kind of ape-like creature gave rise to two evolutionary lines. One led to chimpanzees and other apes, the other to hominids, who eventually became us. C. Owen Lovejoy of Kent State University, one of Ardi's discoverers, says people thought the common ancestor was probably a lot like a chimp. But Lovejoy says he knows chimps, and Ardi was no chimp.
The last common ancestor was more Ardi-like than it was chimpanzee or gorilla-like. So the old attitude that the last common ancestor was chimp-like is completely wrong.
What Lovejoy has to go on are more than 100 bones from 36 individuals, formerly known as Ardipithecus ramidus. Older Ardipithecus specimens are known, but consist of just a few teeth and bones. Tim White, an anthropologist at the University of California, Berkeley, is the team's field director. He brought a model of the skull to Washington to display. It's about the size of a grapefruit. When White found it, he said it was crushed.
I'm pulling out a couple of pieces of wrapping here. The height of this cranium was about an inch. The face was completely missing. We had none of it. So we went back to the field.
Over 15 years, they collected a body.
This thing has all the teeth in the lower jaw and the upper jaw and the bones of the face and the entire cranium.
And the hands and feet. It was a nightmare to put it together.
White says they also recreated the creature's environment.
Collecting every pollen grain, every seed, every piece of wood, every shrew, every bat, every elephant, every giraffe, every horse, every monkey. All of this provides the high-resolution snapshot of what Africa was like in this place our ancestors lived 4.5 million years ago.
White and Lovejoy describe Ardi as a mosaic of ape, monkey, and yet-to-evolve descendant Lucy, formerly known as Australopithecus. Ardi lived in a lush, wooded environment, not the grassy savanna often associated with human ancestors. And it was no knuckle walker. It could walk on its own 2 feet, though those feet were still pretty monkey-like, but it probably spent most of its time in the trees. Its hands differed from chimps as well. And then there are the teeth. The canines are small, unlike the long, threatening canines chimps have. Male chimps use the canines to intimidate other males and gain access to females. Lovejoy says a male Ardipithecus probably did not need big teeth to get what he wanted.
So females are picking males that are using some other technique to obtain reproductive success. And that technique probably is exchanging food for copulation.
That, says Lovejoy, paved the way for the kind of social life humans eventually adopted.
This is much more important than Lucy.
That's Alan Walker, an anthropologist at Penn State University. He says the fossil will kickstart plenty of debate among anthropologists.
As soon as everybody in the field gets to read these things and digest them, people will start the usual academic criticism.
One who's already started is Bernard Wood, an anthropologist at George Washington University.
What I'm not seeing is anything that really convinces me that it's the ancestor of modern humans.
Wood says sometimes unrelated species evolve very similar traits. Bats and birds both have wings, for example. Wood says Ardipithecus could have been a twig on a very different branch from the human line.
We know if you look at the rest of the tree of life, the minority of branches reach the surface. Most of the branches never make it.
The discoverers have published their findings in the journal Science, and they say they're ready for that debate. They've had 15 years to prepare. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
NASA's spacecraft have traveled all over our solar system, and for that you can thank plutonium. Not the kind used in bombs, rather a special kind of plutonium that NASA uses to power space probes that venture far from the sun. Trouble is, supplies of this fuel are running out. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports.
The kind of plutonium used for nuclear weapons is plutonium-239. NASA uses something different, plutonium-238. A marshmallow-sized pellet of this stuff, encased in metal, gives off a lot of heat.
If you dim the lights a little bit, it glows a little red because it's very hot.
Stephen Johnson works on space power systems at the Idaho National Laboratory. He says all that heat can be converted into electricity.
And this electricity is very, very useful when you're in a remote or a hostile environment, such as when you're in space and when you're too far away from the sun to use solar power.
Since 1961, about 24 space missions have used this fuel. Without it, NASA could not have sent out the famous Voyager probes in the 1970s. It could not have launched the Cassini spacecraft, which is orbiting Saturn right now and sending back gorgeous images of the planet's rings. So plutonium-238 is seriously important for planetary science, but NASA is running out. Ralph McNutt is a researcher at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory. He says this material was a byproduct of Cold War activities, and the U.S. hasn't made any new supplies since the 1980s.
We've been living off of the material that we had produced up until that time, and if you keep using material and you have a finite supply, eventually you run out, and that's where we are right now.
For a while, we could buy some from Russia, but they're out too. McNutt says NASA has enough for its next Mars rover, the next planned trip to the outer planets, and one more mission designed to use a small amount of the fuel. And that's about it.
It's kind of like having a car, and if all the gasoline stations are closed and are out of gasoline, and you're out of gas, you're not going to go anywhere.
He says we could still explore places close enough to the sun for solar panels to work, but for going far out into space, there is no substitute for plutonium-238.
There isn't any other option.
McNutt co-chaired a committee of the National Research Council that issued a report in May. It said the shortage has already forced NASA to delay some missions and limit others. And even if the Department of Energy restarts production now, it would still take 8 years to ramp up to making the 11 pounds or so needed by NASA each year. This report seemed to get people's attention. And the administration's budget request for next year included $30 million to move towards new production.
For us, that was a major step forward, a very positive thing for both NASA and Department of Energy.
Hal Bell is director for the Advanced Planning and Analysis Division at NASA headquarters.
Previously, we had not seen that level of commitment.
But over the summer, as a big appropriations bill made its way through Congress, the Senate knocked the amount down to zero, and the House lowered it to just $10 million. Planetary scientists can now only wait to see what happens. Less money would mean more delay. Alan Stern says that would be a setback for NASA.
It really is the kind of thing where people will wake up 10 years from now and say, what were they thinking?
Stern works at the Southwest Research Institute in Colorado and is chief scientist for NASA's New Horizons probe. It's out past Saturn, headed to Pluto.
Our mission is a good example. We're going to Pluto in the Kuiper Belt, where the sunlight is 1,000 times lower and the temperatures are close to absolute zero.
He says this mission could not have happened without plutonium-238. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Once a year, flocks of prairie chickens and grouse gather in the western states to strut and sing for a female mate. We're going to hear this wildlife opera recorded by biologist Garrett Vinn from Cornell University.
About an hour before sunrise, you crawl into a wooden box with, you know, peepholes, wondering, what the heck am I doing here? And then all of a sudden, the birds will appear and start displaying. So what you have there is a group of males in full display. You hear the deep cooing sound of the greater prairie chickens inflating these air sacs in their necks. These brown and white chicken-like birds are shuffling forward. They'll pause in their steps, lunge their head forward, erect these feathers on their neck, and reveal these big orange air sacs. The interaction between the males is really fascinating. They're constantly patrolling the perimeter of, you know, these territories they have on the lek, and they're getting into these really brutal fights where they'll fly at each other and somersault. These sounds are being made by the greater sage grouse, and they fan out this beautiful tail, these long pointy feathers. And as they display, they start swishing their wings over these stiff white breast feathers. And then they sort of, in this violent eruption, launch their chest forward. Sharp-tailed grouse, in their display, arc their wings outward and hunch their head forward. And then they run around sort of like wind-up toys, pounding their feet on the ground. All of these species have undergone drastic population declines. You really do get that feeling when you're out there, like you're experiencing our country as it was.
Our sounds come from the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology.
Someone like me can learn to be like someone. dee dee da ba 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 da doodle da 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 da.